misconduct in office. And in addition, the public, I think, wants an explanation of how Benton Becker was used to represent the interests of the United States in negotiating a TAPES agreement when at that very time he was under investigation by the United States for possible criminal charges. And how also can you explain not having consulted Leon Jaworski, the special prosecutor, before approving of the TAPES agreement? And I think, Mr. President, that these are only a few of the questions that have existed in the public's mind before and unfortunately still remain not resolved. And since I have very brief time, I would like to ask you, in addition to these questions, one further one, and that is that suspicions have been raised that the reason for the pardon and the simultaneous TAPES agreement was to ensure that the tape recordings between yourself and Richard Nixon never came out in public. To alleviate this suspicion once and for all, would you be willing to turn over to this subcommittee all tape recordings of conversations between yourself and Richard Nixon?
Those tapes, under an opinion of the Attorney General, which I sought, according to the Attorney General, and I might add according to past precedent, belong to President Nixon. Those tapes are in our control. They are under an agreement which protects them totally, fully, for the special prosecutor's office or for any other criminal proceedings. Those tapes will not be delivered to anybody until a satisfactory agreement is reached with the special prosecutor's office. We have held them because his office did request that. And as long as we have them held in our possession for the special prosecutor's benefit, I see no way whatsoever that they can be destroyed, that they can be kept from proper utilization in criminal proceedings. Now, those tapes belong to Mr. Nixon, according to the Attorney General, but they're being held for the benefit of the special prosecutor, and I think that's the proper place for them to be kept.
The gentleman from Maryland, Mr. Hogan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm frankly amazed that my good friend, the gentlelady from New York, and her accusatory opening speech, because certainly the gentlelady knows that it is the usual and ordinary and routine procedure of this subcommittee and this committee to operate under the five-minute rule. There is nothing extraordinary about us today allocating 5 minutes of time for questioning to each member of the committee. We always operate this way. Her other observation about not doing any preparatory work by calling other witnesses was rejected, as far as I recall, by all other members of the subcommittee on the basis that this resolution of inquiry is directed to the President of the United States, and properly so. So it would be totally inappropriate for the resolution of inquiry to address itself to individuals other than the subject of that resolution of inquiry. Now, Mr. President, I would like to join, too, in commending you for your statement and your openness and candor in coming in this very historic event. And frankly, I'm concerned that some of the questioning by my colleagues asking questions if all men aren't equal under the law, because certainly, being the outstanding lawyers that they are, they know that the pardoning power itself is inherently inequitable. But for a larger purpose, it grants to the chief executive of the federal government or the state, in the case of state crimes, to pardon individuals who may or have been indicted or convicted of crimes. So we should not expect this to apply as if there were a trial of these criminal offenses,
And furthermore, we also know that in our system of criminal justice, even the prosecutors themselves exercise prosecutive discretion. There is no question whatsoever that the Constitution gives to the President of the United States broad and absolute power to pardon individuals of criminal offenses. We also know from the debates of the framers of the Constitution that they specifically rejected including in the Constitution the words after conviction. They also, in the debate at that time, indicated situations where it might be necessary or desirable to grant a pardon even before indictment, as was the case in this instance. Now, Mr. President, I know that you followed very carefully the deliberations of this committee during the impeachment inquiry. And I know you're also aware that this committee unanimously concluded that the President was guilty of an impeachable offense growing out of obstruction of justice. So, in a sense, couldn't we not say that this was at least the basis for a possible criminal charge, which was already spread on the record with ample evidence to justify it? So those who say you should have waited until there were formalized charges really are overlooking the fact that there was a very formalized charge and indictment, if you will, by this committee.
Well, the unanimous vote of the House Committee on the Judiciary, all 35 members, certainly is very, very substantial evidence that the former president was guilty of an impeachable offense. There's no doubt in my mind that that recommendation of this full committee would have carried in the House, which would have been even more formal as an indication of criminal activity, or certainly, to be more specific, an impeachable offense. And of course, the prospects in the Senate with such a formidable vote in the committee and in the House would have been even more persuasive.
Mr. President, referring to the memorandum from Mr. Ruth to Mr. Jaworski enumerating the 10 possible criminal offenses, it's true that this committee addressed itself, if I'm not mistaken, to every single one of these charges and assessed evidence as to each one of them. And we found them wanting, that they were not sufficient justification for an impeachable offense. And the last paragraph of that memorandum says, and I quote, "None of these matters at the moment rises to the level of our ability to prove even a probable criminal violation by Mr. Nixon." Now, this memorandum does not include the obstruction of justice, which I addressed myself to earlier. So I think we can logically assume that there would not have been any indictments resulting from Mr. Jaworski's activities other than in the area of obstruction of justice. And with further corroboration of that point, I allude to a story in the Wall Street Journal yesterday, where Mr. Jaworski, who incidentally not only agrees with your pardon, but also the legality and the timeliness of it, and he says very specifically that there was going to be no additional disclosures resulting from his activities that the public was not already aware of relating to Mr. Nixon. So those who are saying we should wait till there's a formal charge, I think are missing the point that there already has been a formal charge approved by this committee. Now, Mr. President, don't you feel that the very acceptance of the pardon by the former president is tantamount to an admission of guilt on his part?
I do, sir.
So those who say again that they would have preferred that the president admit his culpability before a pardon being issued, again, are overlooking that fact.
The acceptance of a pardon, according to the legal authorities, and we've checked them out very carefully, does indicate that by the acceptance, the person who's accepted it does in effect admit guilt.
Thank you, Mr. President. And again, I'd like to express my personal appreciation for your candor and your openness and your cooperation with the co-equal branch.
Thank you very much.
Mr. President, as you can see, the peculiar strength of this subcommittee lies in the fact that the subcommittee members bring so much knowledge to it and the subcommittee chairman takes so little away. And I noticed in your page 10 of your statement that when you were first hit with the possibility of this responsibility, you indicated you want to talk to your wife before making decisions. Mr. President, did you do that?
I certainly did, Mr. Chairman, because the probability or possibility of my becoming president obviously would have had a significant impact on her life as well as our life.
That destroys my theory that if you talked to her, you'd wait until indictment or Christmas Eve. Let me ask if any attempt was made to you or your representative to contact the federal pardon attorney as to his opinion as to customary procedures followed in issuing the pardon.
I did not, sir.
Now, Mr. President, I go to page 20. And I'm addressing myself to the health question. In the first responses provided, the press releases, on one of these at page 3, and it refers to September 16th now was the date of this press conference after the pardon decision, in which you're quoted, "I have asked Dr. Lukacs, who's the head physician in the White House, to keep me posted in proper channels as to the former president's health. I've been informed on a routine day-to-day basis, but I don't think I'm at liberty to give information." And my question is, Mr. President, had he reported prior to the pardon date or only after?
Dr. Lukacs gave me no information concerning President Nixon's health prior to the time that I issued the pardon. He did, at my request, when I heard rumors about the former president's health, keep me posted in proper channels. But that all occurred after the pardon took place.
Gentleman from Indiana seeking recognition.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would just like to request that we make a part of the record the text of the opinion of the United States Supreme Court in Ex parte Garland, 4 Wallace 333, and also the opinion of the United States Supreme Court in verdict against the United States, 236 U.S. 79, which deals with the point that a pardon must be accepted.
And without objection, it will be made part of the record.
Mr. Chairman, I would also like to make a part of the record, if I may, the article referred to by my colleague, Mr. Hogan, which appeared in the Wall Street Journal of October 16, 1974, and is headed, "The Pardon of Nixon Was Timely, Legal, Jaworski Believes."
Without objection, it is so ordered, and now,
briefly, Mr. Chairman, may I add to something I said just to make it correct?
Yes, sir.
Somebody asked about when I last saw the president. I said that I had seen him on the 9th. I did as he departed, but I had also seen the president the morning of the 8th. At the time, I was asked to come and see him, and at that time, we spent an hour and 20 minutes together or thereabouts when he told me that he was going to resign. So I saw him both the 8th and the 9th, just to make the record accurate.
All of us are aware of our time constraints. I yield to the gentleman from Wisconsin for a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would like to, for the record, indicate that the statement of the gentleman from Maryland, Mr. Hogan, the effect that the proposal that this subcommittee try to contact certain staff members, such as General Haig and others, was supported by me. I think it would have been excellent. We have in the past done very well in terms of staff work, preliminary to hearings, that might have helped put some of the questions Ms. Holzman had to rest. Mr. President, you indicated that as far as Mr. Haig was concerned, that he had suggested certain options to you, but did not, in fact, make a recommendation to you with respect to the pardon. Is
that
correct?
Is correct. I answered that, I think, as fully as I can in my prepared statement. He discussed the options. He made no recommendation.
Which other persons, to you personally, made recommendations that the former president be pardoned from that time in early August to the day of September 6th when you made your decision?
No other person, to my knowledge, made any recommendation to me from that time until the time that I made a decision about September 6th. Nobody made any recommendation to me for the pardon of the former president.
With respect to discussions between General Haig and Mr. Nixon or other matters in question two, you indicated you had no personal knowledge, both in writing and in your statement today. I take it you would have no objection if the subcommittee sought to question Mr. Haig or others on the subject before us this morning to supplement this hearing and this inquiry.
I don't think that's within my prerogative. I have come here to testify as the specific facts as I know them. But what the subcommittee does is a judgment for the subcommittee and not me.
The chair has advised that the House is in recess waiting for the conclusion of this hearing before reconvening. So if I might, I will yield to Mr. Hogan for a question at this point and then to Ms. Holston for a question, and we will then conclude. Mr. Hogan?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. President, on page 20 of your statement, you talk about the health issue and that you had not gotten any official reports from physicians about that were controlling in your decision. You state that observations were reported to you from others. Now, there have been press reports that Dr. Kissinger is alleged to have said to you that he feared that former President Nixon would commit suicide. That appeared in several news accounts. Is there any truth to that?
There's no truth to it whatsoever.
Well,
as far as I know,
it appeared in the New York Times, the Washington Post, on two occasions, and is alluded to in a research paper prepared for the subcommittee. But
there was no discussion between Dr. Kissinger and myself that included any such comment.
I think, if I might add a gratuitous comment, Mr. Chairman, that much of the controversy has been generated by the press by just such erroneous statements that have been given wide circulation.
Thank you,
Mr. President.
Yes. I'll ask for one concise question because
thank you,
we want to respect the time.
Mr. President, what were the precise instructions given to Benton Becker by you when he went to San Clemente to negotiate the Mr. Nixon's acceptance of the pardon?
The precise instructions given to Mr. Becker were actually given by my counsel, Mr. Buchan. In general, I knew what they were. They were instructions to negotiate the protection of those documents, including the tapes, for the benefit of the special prosecutor in whatever use he felt was essential, and at the same time to keep them inviolate during a period of time which we felt was a proper one.
But not to offer the pardon unless that agreement had been negotiated?
Mr. Edwards, those negotiations as to the custody or ownership of the documents, including tapes, were undertaken prior to August 27th, because we were more or less besieged, when I say we, the White House, as to what to do with those documents, including tapes. And that negotiation had no relevance whatsoever to the decision on my part to pardon the president.
The chair would remind all of the constraints of time and call on Ms. Holston for one final question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Ford, you stated that the theory on which you pardoned Richard Nixon was that he had suffered enough. And I'm interested in that theory because the logical consequence of that is that somebody who resigns in the face of virtually certain impeachment or somebody who is impeached should not be punished because the impeachment or the resignation in face of impeachment is punishment enough. And I wondered whether anybody had brought to your attention the fact that the Constitution specifically states that even though somebody is impeached, that person shall nonetheless be liable to punishment according to law.
Mrs. Holtzman, I was fully cognizant of the fact that the president, on resignation, was accountable for any criminal charges. But I would like to say that the reason I gave the pardon was not as to Mr. Nixon himself. I repeat, and I repeat with emphasis, the purpose of the pardon was to try and get the United States, the Congress, the President, and the American people focusing on the serious problems we have both at home and abroad. And I was absolutely convinced then, as I am now, that if we had had this series, an indictment, a trial, a conviction, and anything else that transpired after that, that the attention of the President, the Congress, and the American people would have been diverted from the problems that we have to solve. And that was the principal reason for my granting of the pardon.
Ms. Smith.
Mr. Chairman, just before we adjourn this hearing, I again would like to commend the President and thank him for coming. I think, Mr. President, that you have probably opened a new era between the executive and the legislative departments, and I'm very happy for it.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I want to express to you and to the other members of the committee or subcommittee my appreciation for the fine manner and I think the fair way in which this meeting was held this morning. I felt that it was absolutely essential because I'm the only one who could explain the background and the decision-making process. And I hope, as I said in my opening statement, Mr. Chairman, that I have at least cleared the air so that most Americans will understand what was done and why it was done. And again, I trust that all of us can get back to the job of trying to solve our problems both at home and abroad. I thank you very, very much.
Chairman, Mr. President, on behalf of the subcommittee, we express our appreciation to your appearance here today and recognition of the responsibility we all have to complete this work and get on with the business. The transcripts will be furnished as quickly as possible to members of the subcommittee. The subcommittee will adjourn subject to call of the chair.
Thank you.